God, that Skype song is loud.
Sorry.
So loud. I have a horrible headache.
Oh, why?
I don't know.
Just old age.
Probably. I ate a Twizzler today, which, you know, is sugar, so it probably has something to do with it. Also, I'm pretty sure it's unrelated, but I think my USB hub stopped working, or at least part of it stopped working.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think it's related to the sugar in the Twizzler, but you never know with these things.
The sugar in the Twizzler.
Sugar. The sugar is the Twizzler.
Mm-hmm.
How's it going with you over there?
Fine. Just busy. Very, very dot biz at the moment.
Oh, ain't that the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not fun.
No, no. Makes you very tired and not at all entertaining to listen to.
No, not particularly.
You know.
But, you know, people listen. People tune in for things. I don't know. I don't think they necessarily tune in for the tiredness of it all. But,
They're just not really interested in listening to exhaustion.
Well, we're not interested in, you know, putting out exhaustion, but that tends to be the case from time to time.
Well, I mean, there are certain regulations that one needs to adhere to. Although, you know, it's going to be taken to court, that whole thing with the exemption for California and its exhaustion.
I get the sense that you're doing a bit.
Yep.
Yeah.
Like exhaust.
Oh, this is the car thing, the regulation thing.
Yeah, it was a... It's a timely car joke.
Yeah, they're allowed to be as exhausted or non-exhausted as they choose.
Yes.
Because they're California.
Oiga Vault. But anyway.
Off to a banging start here.
Yeah, so the other week, you brought up Mission Impossible again, and...
I mean, again, like I'm haranguing you constantly about Mission Impossible.
No, not constantly, but it's come up on more than one occasion. Mainly whenever, you know, Tom Cruise comes up or there's a new Mission Impossible movie released and it's like, hey, what about that? And I'm always, you know, stick in the mud. And I'm like, I don't like Tom Cruise and I don't really want to financially support him most of the time. And that's not difficult for me to say because I don't really like enjoy his performances so much. But I have seen the first two Mission Impossible movies and decided I'm good.
decided that was enough.
Yeah.
What if people had stopped listening to our podcast after the first two episodes? Imagine what they would have missed.
Oh, you're right. That's a brilliant counter argument.
Imagine if we would have made it all the way to six.
Yeah. No.
And then announced two more.
Well, I actually got confused the other day when I opened up the Wikipedia page and I saw the number of because they like next to the producers in parentheses they put the number of movies they're producing, and I was reading that as had produced, and I'm like, wow, there's been eight of these, and no, it's just there's two that are greenlit, untitled Mission Impossible projects that are coming up. But anywho, I think you saw your good friend Stu Meshwitz was on a podcast about Mission Impossible, which I did not know existed, but, you know, there's a podcast about everything.
I didn't know that existed either until he retweeted the thing, and then I listened to the first one. I'm like, oh, this is pretty good. I mean, the parts where he tells, you know, stories and stuff.
Yeah, I listened to the episodes they did with Paul Hirsch, who was the editor on this and many other fine movies, and I listened to the Stu Meshwitz ones, but I did not listen to the entire catalog of all of them. They apparently even at some point talked to somebody who's in charge of the Paramount theme park efforts in South Korea.
There's a Mission Impossible theme park?
Not yet, but there will be. At least there's going to be a theme park that is going to be Paramount themed and will have Mission Impossible things in it.
Is this like one of those like Shrek 4D rides where you like sit in a chair and watch it, but it blasts you with like sweat when he's like dangling from the ropes?
No, they put you in, you know, those the drop rides where they put you in like a chair and then they hydraulically lift it up and then they drop it.
How high? You mean like a couple of feet, or like the ones that go like 60 feet up?
Yeah, the big ones. The big ones. What they could do is they raise you up like Tower of Terror style or something, and then you're like, you're inside the air conditioning shaft, and then you can't touch the floor, and then they drop you, and then they spray water on you at the very end.
Actually, you know, spoiler for, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah, they do a cool one there that would also work as a Tower of Terror ride.
Okay. Well, maybe. Anyway, there's possibilities apparently, but I certainly am not as big of a fan. I would never claim to be as big of a fan as the two gentlemen who host the podcast are. So if you are disappointed in any respect, listener, about the depth of my knowledge or Dan's knowledge, or I don't know, just disappointed about everything, then I guess you can go tune into them for a very specific amount of Mission Impossible information.
Yeah, we
and
should make it clear
access to guests
that we're not going to have the in-depth behind the scenes information that these other people are very passionate about and have dug up. We're just gonna talk about the movie, because that's what you expected after 257 of these, where we just talk about the movie.
Yeah, that's what we do here. We
maintain expectations is what we do.
Yeah, imagine if you stopped listening after the second one, you wouldn't have your expectations maintained.
I mean, 2 points, you can't really make a trend line from there.
Mm.
You need three.
No. At 258 points, now you got a line.
That's, you know, there's probably a lot of metadata that one could extract from our shows in terms of themes and things that we are and are not consistent about. And I really don't want to know what those things are, but I feel like there's a lot of data there.
Something tells me it's very bro movie heavy. A lot of action.
A lot of bad
comedy and bad movies. Movies with low scores. Yeah. Space. Lots of space. Just our personal biases.
Yeah, we both love space so much.
Yes, both of us. Anyway, this movie, Mission Impossible. Mission: Impossible. It's like they had a first movie and it was named Mission, and then they said, this is the sequel. It's named Impossible.
The sequel to Mission Impossible. No, it's because I feel like I was all the way into like the third movie or something stupid before I realized that IMF was the Impossible Mission Force.
Mm-hmm.
Which is very stupid. But that's, you know, source material, so what are you going to do?
Yeah, well, this is, I don't know about you, but when I first saw this movie in 1996, I was
blown
away,
just like me.
Well, I was going to say, I was not super aware of...
Oh, no, definitely not.
Mission Impossible as a series. And I've heard, I think particularly in the cartoon shows of the era, spoofs on... Mission Impossible themed stuff, especially with like the theme song score and like a little fuse running out, etc. Not really understanding where that reference was coming from, because that's just what happened with people who made cartoons, is they put in the references that they knew.
Right. Well, I guess, did you ever watch Get Smart or whatever on late night reruns or wherever it was?
Oh, yeah. I love Get Smart.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the closest I think I would have had to an awareness. I think coming out of this movie, whoever I saw it with, my dad probably said, you know, that was a TV show or whatever. And I was like, oh, when? And he would have informed me briefly about it. And I would say, wow, that sounds terrible. Mm-hmm. And then Tom Cruise was cool.
Yeah. He used to be Maxwell Smart. Talked into a shoe.
Productivity expert. 15 tips on how to hack your foreign government.
Yeah, Agent 99 folders. sorry. No.
That was good. That's mm-hmm. the best. That's the best thing we're gonna say in this whole podcast, right there.
That Steve Carell movie was terrible, though. But.
I saw part of it. Is that the one? Is The Rock in that?
Yes, and Anne Hathaway,
yes.
Putty
from Seinfeld.
Blanking on his name.
Patrick Warburton.
Patrick Warburton. And what is it, Terrence Stamp, and I'm at a loss for the rest of the names of the people involved. Oh, and Alan Arkin.
I feel like Alan Arkin was in there.
Alan Arkin played the boss. He was very Alan Arkin, as you would want if you hired Alan Arkin. He just shows up and he shouts at you. But the that was a terrible movie. Now, not having been a fan or really having any knowledge of the original series of Mission Impossible, I did not have those preconceived notions about it going into this. I did, however, think that it was about a team who worked together on a mission that was impossible. And I was a little surprised as a kid because that's not really what happens in the movie. Very quickly, you are thrown out of the team dynamic and into this one-man vendetta against whoever betrayed his team. And you kind of just spend the rest of the time with Tom Cruise, and it's like, well, this is very Tom Cruise-centric. And since Tom Cruise can only act like Tom Cruise, really, most of the time, or at least that's why people seem to employ him and what he seems to choose to do as the producer of his movies, then he kind of just is himself. And it's not as interesting to me.
You said that yesterday after, or maybe even before having watched it, and other people had said, like, yeah, it's, you know, it's Tom Cruise heavy, and I wish there was more of a team. But watching it this time, I feel like this movie has a substantial amount of its runtime that is not footage of Tom Cruise. I mean, maybe I'm just comparing this movie to the more recent ones that I've seen, where I feel like he's in every shot in the entire film. But, you know, there's team stuff in here. I don't know that he necessarily gets a whole, well, he gets special treatment or whatever because he's the main character, but I don't know that it's like, it didn't bother or stand out to me.
Okay.
Especially in the first half of the movie. He's definitely not, like, the main dude until everyone's dead, I guess.
Well, that's not even the first half. Everyone dies pretty quick.
Yeah. It's funny, watching this on the couch just a bit ago, Amanda was there, and, you know, she hasn't seen this in a long time, and we both probably haven't seen the beginning in a very long time, although I remember it. You know, they're all sitting around the table, and Emilio's there. She's like, oh, I didn't remember him being in this movie. I was like, well, he's not in it for very long.
No.
She's like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, he gets a big piece of metal shoved into his face.
Yeah, it's a really shocking death
to see. It's really gruesome, isn't it, for a PG-13 movie? Like, I mean, there's not, like, gore and blood and stuff, but, like, you see the impact.
Oh, yeah.
And it's unsettling.
No more triple deeks for him. No, but the...
Although those glasses with the lights on the side are always so cool.
No.
They're so cool.
All the glasses in this movie are terrible.
The styles, like, the Tom Cruise glasses that he wears are terrible. But, like, the ones with the little lights, they're so hackery, where he's, like, you know, he's doing his wire work with the knife and the things, and he's got his computer.
I guess. I'm going to agree to disagree on that one, but I think this is more of a personal taste issue. But this movie starts with a cold open, and it's about... You come in on this operation that's happening where there's a guy who seems to be working with these people who are monitoring the situation in Kiev, and you're seeing the monitor output of what appears to be a situation where a guy is being coerced into revealing something, and there's a woman lying on a bed, and the implication seems to be that he's supposed to have believed that he killed her, but you hear them say in dialogue, like, she's been under for too long, you know, she's got to come up, etc. So you know that this is all, like, orchestrated with the two guys against the guy they're trying to get the information from, and then the team working on the over the video monitors, and it's very economical in the way that it delivers that. There's nothing really super fancy happening here until the guy reveals the name, and then they disassemble basically the fake room that they were in.
I feel like in 1996 that was probably fairly, like, striking when, like, he opens the door and he's there and it's like, oh, he's not just in the other room, there's a fake room with the walls that come down and stuff. That was probably pretty cool in 1996, but here you're just like, well, yeah, that's spy mission, like, I get it.
Also the face thing, because we have Tom
mask.
Yeah, we have Tom Cruise in makeup, but he peels it all off and one big Halloween mask, and it reveals that it's Tom Cruise underneath. So that's not how that works, really. you've got your prosthetic makeup work by Rob Botten or Rob Botten. I'm not really sure how to pronounce it.
Botten.
Yeah. If you
would have listened to the Stew podcast, you would have gotten the pronunciation correct.
I did listen to it. I just forgot, Dan. All right. So anyway, Rob Botten, you would remember him from the thing, John Carpenter thing, where he almost poisoned himself and several other people with the noxious chemicals that he would combine in order to make the effects that he was doing. But he did the stuff going on here that you see. And when you have this version, this little fake version, that's, you know, cute or whatever. And then when you get the senator later, when all of a sudden he's a Six Flags old man guy, this is also pretty effective. It's just funny watching the whole face peel off shenanigans stuff, because that's not how makeup works. And they never really address in the in this movie how he comes by these face masks that he procures.
Well, it's a good thing you want to know more about how the masks work, because that's going to stick around for lots of the movies, and there'll be lots of explanations that you will really hate.
Oh, I'm going to regret that.
You're going to regret that. No, I remember...
Is it a Darkman-like thing? Like, what happens?
No, there's just lots of machines and things and, like, 3D printers, and it's all very bad. It's a plot point in one of the movies. I won't spoil which one. I do remember distinctly seeing the second one with a friend of mine. I don't know, whatever. That would have been middle school, probably high school. No, middle school. I don't know. Whatever it was. And he was a big movie fan, too. And he's like, you know what? By the time they did the third mask thing, I was, like, fully over it, because it was just like, it's just like the... Deus Ex Maschina or whatever. Like, when anytime they needed to screw something up, they're just like, here's a mask now, and it's the voice is perfect and nobody can tell, and it's just like, so tired of it. But in this movie, it's used fairly with some restraint, so like I think it's okay here, even if it is kind of silly.
Yeah,
they didn't get into the you know, the thing they stick on. Wait, is that in the second one where they put the little sticker on the throat? Yeah, I think it is.
Sure.
It's like a sticker that has like wiring in it that they stick on their Adam's apple, and then that changes their voice.
No, that doesn't happen here. Because there's that moment at the end when you see one character and you're like, that's not that character, but it's also not Tom Cruise because it's that actor. How are they going to deal with the voice thing? And it's like, well, they don't. He just sits there silently.
And in the first bit there, he's doing a voice. He's doing a Ross Perot or something.
Well, he's doing. I'm not sure if they're speaking Czech or like.
Oh, that guy. Yeah, that guy's. Yeah, we don't know who that guy is.
Yeah,
I meant the when he pretends to be the senator.
Yeah, when he pretends to be the senator, he definitely has some sort of South Tennessee thing happening. Tennessee, Kentucky.
He's playing Dana Carvey playing an SNL character.
Yeah. But without any of the levity. But anywho, this cold open ends with Tom Cruise's face being peeled off, the bad guy being poisoned, sort of incapacitated, I'm going to assume.
They're very gentle poisons in this movie. They give one fella real bad food poisoning, and he just throws up a lot, and I'm sure there were no ill side effects from that. And then this other guy's just passed out. And then Claire's dead, but they make her undead with a really fat needle that was definitely not fake.
No. And he has a real strange way of waking up people where he just puts his hand on their face and leaves it there for an extended period of time. If I ever woke up and somebody just had their hand just wrapped around my jaw.
If you woke up and Tom Cruise was cupping your face, yeah, he would probably have a slightly different reaction than like nuzzling into his hand.
Yeah, no, thank you. You know, that's basically the end of this, and then they go into the title sequence. However, I found out from listening to the other podcast that apparently there was a whole other alternate opening where they have an extended conversation after she wakes up, and he's trying to like get her going, and then there seems to be some sort of quasi implication of them being close, and there's a close up on the wedding ring, and then that goes to close up on John Voight's wedding ring in the next scene, but instead they're like, nope. And so they keep it nice and snappy, cut it off there, like as if you were doing a television show with established characters, and then go into the extended title sequence where you hear, is it Lalo Schifrin? I'm not sure. The pronunciation of the name is very iconic, very recognizable theme for Mission Impossible, and you get all the Fuse stuff, and then you get your best mid-90s motion graphics for text, you know, smearing on and flickering around, you set up the whole thing and it explodes, yay, and then we're on an airplane, and there's a stewardess, flight attendant, handing out movies for people to watch, because cassette. This is the mid-90s, and
it looked like an incredibly luxurious first class seat as well.
Oh yeah, they don't do it like that anymore. They really cram you in
first
class.
I want to live in that world. Like, I feel like that's the diehard airplane world too, where the seats are huge and it's nice and dark and quiet and comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, all the seats in there are like 50 feet apart from each other, so it seems like you have ample room.
They're certainly far enough apart that nobody can like look over your seat and notice that you're watching a CIA sanctioned film.
Oh well, the CIA sanctioned film is also smaller than like a video iPod screen, so
nobody wants to watch video on their first class TV.
No. He says that he likes the theater, and then she says, oh well, we'll try this thing, and then he pops that in, and it turns out to be the CIA sanctioned film, and it's like, oh, that's kind of a clever like code word, you know, Cold War era like secret spy drop thing. So he watches his information download on the mission, and then the tape self-destructs, and he hides the self-destructing tape by lighting up a cigarette, and you're like, oh yeah, you can smoke on airplanes.
It's a great way to cover it up. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, yeah, you would just be thrown out of the plane while it was flying.
Mm. And so we get them setting up the team in Prague, they have the bird's nest or something they refer to it as, their
crow's nest, I don't know,
yeah,
something like that.
They basically have secured an apartment where they set up all their secret spy stuff, and that includes their power book, that they start going through all their little operation things on, and John Voight's character, Jim Phelps, confirms it's the rest of the team and says, oh, everything went great with your thing, and thanks for looking after my wife, and they're like, oh, what would you do? And he's like, oh, you know, and Tom Cruise is teasing him, he's like, oh, you must have stayed at a real fancy hotel, it was the Plaza, and he's like, oh, it was the Drake Hotel in Chicago, and you're like, that is weirdly specific about a Chicago hotel that mm-hmm. most people would not know. But
also, I've stayed at the Drake Hotel, not that nice.
Oh, snap.
It's very old. The floors were slanted.
Ew.
I mean, it's close to the water, too, so it's probably sinking into the lake, but what are you going to do?
Sinking into the lake or sinking into the river?
This is a lake, isn't it?
Yeah, but there's a river through Chicago that feeds into the lake.
Oh, yeah, no, it's over by I think it's closer to the lake. Who knows? Okay. Maybe the whole city is just, like, the sinking.
Yes, it's the Venice of the Midwest, but, you think that's some throwaway thing. No, it's Chekhov's Gideon Bible. There's some stuff about the mission dynamics and who will be doing what. It's not terribly important for you, viewer, because it makes total sense. One thing that Brian De Palma is very good at, and the writer, David Koepp, is very good at, is making sure that you're aware that this thing is this thing, and that thing is that thing, and then moving right along without making it feel overly onerous, because this is supposed to be a debriefing anyways, but it's a debriefing with people that already know each other, so you don't get a lot of like weird people saying other people's names or anything like that, like first-time introductions. Emilio,
what do you think of the feel of this movie while you're briefly touching on the directing and writing and stuff?
The feel?
Yeah, I mean, just in terms of tone and pacing and stuff like that, because to me this feels like a movie from the early 90s or 80s even, just in terms of the way it's constructed, in a good way too, because it's sort of that like that reverential era of old school cinema kind of style to it in my mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is this is sort of strange because there's an element of like Cold War spy movie mixed with
a lot of sitting and talking, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's the Cold War spy movie part. and then it's mixed with a lot of tension, like almost I would say like Hitchcockian tension for a lot of it. And there's some action sprinkled in, which is done very well, but it doesn't feel like your 2000s and on blockbuster action movie.
It doesn't feel too Mission Too Impossible.
No. Everything's very contained to set pieces, and you move from one position to the other. So it has these different like tones and flavors in it, and they blend well because you're not straying too far into any one of these, and none of them are specifically in conflict with one another. It's not like all of a sudden it like pivots into an animated film or anything, or there's some weird off-kilter comedy or romance situation. There is hinted at some affection that characters have for one another, but it's not like when we watch The World Is Not Enough. And there's that really strange relationship that develops between James Bond and Sophie Marceau's character, and then he goes on to have another strange relationship with Denise Richards' character, and you're just like, this is so wacky and not at all what I would have expected, but whatever. So it doesn't feel like that. And this does not feel like a James Bond movie, and it doesn't feel like what you would get a little while later with Jason Bourne movies. It doesn't feel like that either, even though, you know, you have some of the same kinds of things, like an agent who is against his own people because of basically an error. It's...
I'm so glad you've said all of this, and I'm so glad we've committed to watching all of these movies, because we're going to come back. Like these chickens are going to come home to roost in a very interesting way, I think.
Why are you threatening me with chickens?
What's wrong with chicken?
I mean, I like chicken to eat. I just don't want them roosting.
They got to roost.
Don't let them roost. I don't want no roosting. But the
suddenly we're a Seinfeld bit.
these roostings are making me so chicken. But I think it all works because you pivot from Cold War to tension to action, and then back to Cold War, and then tension and action, and it builds in these three separate events. Basically, you get the opening at the embassy. The aquarium thing, restaurant, and you get the CIA Langley set piece, and you get the train set piece at the very end. So I guess that's four things, because I was counting the aquarium thing. But the aquarium thing's short. I don't really need to count that one. It's a small aquarium.
A big aquarium, small scene.
Yes.
Coming soon to HGTV. There are relatively few major set pieces. Like, you don't lose track of all of the absurd action that may or may not occur in more modern cinema because, like, spectacle is the thing now.
Well, it's also an era where you had to plan things, so there's clarity. Because, I don't know about you, but in more modern filmmaking, sometimes people will just shoot things, even though they don't know what they're doing. And then they're gonna figure it out later. So, you know, that can happen.
I generally don't do that if you're going to do something as silly as, like, hang Tom Cruise off the side of a skyscraper.
No.
You can't just really wing that one on the day.
No. I feel like there is very rigorous planning that specifically went into this movie. Because you're dealing with effects setups, like special effects on the set setups of this needs to explode and this needs to do this and that needs to do that. And we need to have a camera here to record that. And then another camera over there to record this other reaction to the thing.
You gotta have special gum that's half one color and half another color.
Yeah. So you gotta make sure the prop department can do that. You can't just digitally change half of the stick of gum later.
Now, what color would you want the gum to be in order to change the other half? Because the green was substantially darker in brightness, or what's the word?
Darker in brightness?
It's darker in luminance. I don't know. I was trying to say a word. I was like HSV, and then I was like, I'm not going to say value, because nobody knows what the hell I'm talking about.
No, but I just feel like there's
more... sorry, somebody, listener Rye just wrote darker and brightness as the title suggested. Thank you, Rye. Appreciate you profiting off of my tiredness and headache.
That's okay. You know, everybody's a little dim every now and then.
Darker and brightness could be the name of the next James Bond movie.
It could be, but they'd run all the words together in a weird way, and then one of the characters would say it. Sometimes, James, we're darker in brightness.
yeah, exactly.
No, but there's more clarity to what's happening, so it makes more sense when you're going from one thing to the other thing. Everything's planned out, especially when you get to Langley. You can't just wing that one.
Right, it's fairly straightforward too. Like, a lot of these movies have relatively convoluted plot lines, where in this one it is convoluted. Like, he gets double crossed and all of his folks get killed and he's super pissed about that, and in order to figure out who did it, he's going to complete the mission of the double crosser and like steal the thing before they could steal it and go directly to the contact that he was going to sell the stuff to, and try and, like, you know, find out who it was that way. So he's going to become the bad guy in order to find the real bad guy, and then, you know, become the good guy again, which is silly. You figure he would just, like, you know, write a nice letter to Kittredge and explain himself, and then go into hiding for a little while they sorted things out. But no, he's going to take it into his own hands.
No, but it's also a situation where, like you're saying, it's convoluted. It doesn't really make any sense, because if he messes up at all, then
he's literally just adding more evidence against him.
Yeah, well, not just more evidence against him, like if he gets caught, but if he actually succeeds in doing the bad thing and giving the bad thing to the bad people, then he's like killed multiple times the number of people that would have been killed had he done absolutely zero things.
Did he really kill that many people?
Well, no, he was accused of killing. Sorry.
Oh, yes. Allegedly. Of course. He didn't actually kill anybody in this one.
Right. He was framed.
Yeah. But, you know, if he's good enough, if he's impossible mission force enough to steal the knock list, he can certainly prevent it from getting out in the open with a Nokia modem jammer.
Mm-hmm. Well,
they really have a backup plan there.
They should have used a knock listia modem jammer. But,
you want to try that one again?
No, I messed it up. But let's go back to the thing. So they're set up on their mission, and Jim Phelps is all like, "Thanks for taking care of my wife," and it's like, that's a weird tone. And anyway,
very John Wayne, what you just did there.
Well, I don't know. I was going for more of John Voight, but I guess I've only really seen John Voight in Mission Impossible and Anaconda.
You've never watched what's the one where Nicolas Cage steals the Declaration of Independence?
National Treasure.
Yeah.
No, Dan, because I saw the trailer for National Treasure and I said, well, no, thank you.
John Voight is Nicolas Cage's dad, which, you know.
Oh, how?
Put that in your brain and think about it for a little while.
John Voight really shouldn't be anybody's dad. Evidence is available. for you to pick up at your local Google, it's a strange thing. But then they're going to go right to the mission, and they do. And in the they do the handoff of gear and things, which consists of Emilio Estevez's Q character being like, "Hey, look, here's gum that you fold these two things together and it explodes. And here are glasses where you don't see a lens or any bulk added to them at all, but they record things with what appears to be an anamorphic 35mm resolution." So yeah, that's interesting. But they have that set up so that way you can get to the mechanics of what they're going to do. And they reveal, like, "Oh, we're going to override this thing and do that. And you're going to impersonate the senator who's going to be fly fishing." And so then they roll up into the embassy, and they do a very clever thing here where we get it from Tom Cruise's point of view. So the camera is Tom Cruise, and we as the audience are the senator going through this party. So it's an interesting way to tell the story, because we don't immediately start with some omnipresent view of, you know, Tom Cruise walking in there in his outfit. Instead, we get used to his weird voice that he's trying to do, and him meeting all the people, and then we you know, pull out of that to reveal himself in his Six Flag Old Man costume and all the other people at the party.
That's what they got to hurry up and get the Nautilus because the Venga bus is coming and they got to catch that on the way out.
We should do a mashup of that thing and then the Mission Impossible theme.
Can we, is there a way to do a deep fake thing where we make Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible character do the dance from the Six Flags dude and then put the music in there?
There is, theoretically, judging by all the deep fakes I've seen.
Cut him out and then do like an IK thing and then you can hand animate him or something if you have to.
I'm busy. no, thank you, sir.
You've gone from I'm fine to I'm busy.
I'm very busy. But
you're not busy. Your time constraint. No, you're actually busy. I'm busy too. It's fine.
Incredibly busy. But it's an interesting way to introduce us to the character and the setting, and to set us up in the scene, and we can get acclimated to that without immediately just staring at the weird prosthetic. And we also
it's good. Yeah, they do POV a couple of times in this movie, don't they? Where it somehow manages to mix in reasonably well. I mean, in this instance, like you pointed out, it's to sort of show us the video feed and to sort of cushion the blow of Tom Cruise and his makeup and stuff like that. But there are a couple others, I think. Well, obviously, there's the dangly bits in the vault and some other things. But I like the way they use POV. You don't see people using and getting away with POV footage very often in movies.
No, but I feel like they're aided by the fact that there's the contrivance of the glasses, like you said. And we have the sort of weird handoff thing happening with Hannah at the top of the stairs, who's monitoring everything, and her shades can go purple, blue, and then reveal the rotoscoped green blob that gets sprayed on by Sarah onto the back of the target's head.
Mm-hmm. So that definitely she can tracks very well, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does not. It's floaty. But she tracks him across the ballroom where he's going and what he's doing. And there's also a recognition by Ethan Hunt of various other people here, although he reveals that he recognizes them later. They go to the elevator. And Emilio Estevez had been crawling through the ducts to get to the elevator to place the little boxy thing on the thing and to hack the system.
Yeah, he gets stuck behind the elevator when it stops or whatever, and he's like, oh, man. For all intents and purposes, he's a very bad hacker, even though in the little review video from Kittredge, he's like, he can hack anything. It's like, well, apparently not. He does, like, one out of the eight things he was supposed to do, and then he gets himself killed.
Yeah, but he only gets himself killed because he trusted the team leader to not push the button on the computer that made the elevator go straight up and cause metal spikes
to deploy. Yeah. Do you think every embassy has spikes above its elevator?
You know, that's a very good question, Dan, and I'm sure in the future we can do a podcast about that, but I don't have the information at hand. I'm not prepared to discuss.
You should come prepared. You're gonna get a letter grade off on this one.
Yeah. But they do the thing where they have movie computer interface where it's like, here's the thing, and it does the stuff, and I got to upload the thingy to the thingy.
You got to hack the thing and open the elevator doors. And the whole premise here is, some bad guy's going to come steal half of the Nautilus. He's already got the other half, and we got to prevent them from getting both halves because then he has the whole thing. What we need to do is get video evidence of him stealing the thing, tail him to meet his buyer, and then arrest them both. You know, basically, they're going to infiltrate the dealers and find the suppliers and arrest them both to prevent the Nautilus from getting out. Although you would think something of such gigantic national security, they wouldn't even want the guy to get the thing. They would like see him starting to download it, and then they would just immediately capture him and then just, you know, put him in an underground bunker and beat him until he tells them who his buyer was.
Yeah, except he wanted to catch. They want to catch the Max, the character revealed to be the arms dealer.
Sure, come up with another plan, though, instead of, like, literally giving the guy the disc and, like, trying to follow him.
Well, but see, the thing is, what this team didn't know is that this wasn't actually the disc. It was another team.
The whole thing was a ruse.
Yes. It's all a clever facade. Now,
it's a mole hunt.
No.
By the way, I have to say, I love Henry Cerny as Kittredge in this movie. I think he's great.
I hate Henry Cerny as Kittredge in this movie.
Oh, come on, why?
He has such an affected Agent Smith way of speaking.
He's so smug and CIA and government-y boy. It's perfect.
But I just don't like especially when they get the aquarium scene where he's just like, yes, you know that. And it's like, no, no, nobody talks. Why are you doing that? Don't do that. Just talk like a person. Talk like a person right now.
His affectation is the Brian De Palma of accents. It's perfect. It fits. It fits with the movie. It's not real, but it's his character.
I really disagree on that one.
There's confusion as to whether or not he's like, you know, when they're in the aquarium, you can't tell like if he knows stuff ahead of time or if he's just sort of like acting a little bit, because he is kind of acting a little bit, or if he's legitimately that weird, that weird accented type person or whatever. But I like him. I think he's good.
I think he's better in the later scenes where he's not as affected. I feel like they wanted the aquarium scene to be a little more heightened, I suppose.
You mean with all of the incredibly close-up, low Dutch angles in their faces?
Oh my god, this movie has so many Dutch angles. I want to find out like what the Dutch angle ratio of the movie is.
There were a few where it's just like, you don't need to be doing that anymore right now, but you still are.
Well, I mean, one of the things you got to like Brian De Palma movies for is a bravery to use certain techniques to make the audience feel unsettled by the use of the technique, and to also reveal information in a way that adds tension and unsettles the audience, specifically the split diopter and the split diopter Dutch angle, which are it's a hell of a combo when you think about it. Back to this particular thing, they do the thumbprint scan, the touch ID fails, and the security guard comes out and he takes her badge and goes back to the security guard booth so that they can run through the list of things in a very, very slow slideshow of people who could possibly be at the embassy.
This is in so many movies too, mm-hmm. where they're like uploading the ID badge thing at the last. It's in other Mission Impossible movies too, like uploading your credentials at the last possible minute.
We should watch Sneakers. But anyway, they
are we allowed to watch Sneakers?
I feel like Dan Morin would kill me if we watched Sneakers and didn't invite him on the podcast.
I feel like there are multiple people who would kill us if we watched Sneakers and didn't invite them on the podcast. Mm. We should invite all the people on the podcast and then let them have the podcast about it.
We just won't show up.
We'll do the intro and the outro and be like, that was episode whatever of Defocus. Hope you enjoyed yourself.
Yeah, give yourselves a week off. But they upload the thing and they come back and say sorry, and then hand the thing off, and then the senator and Sarah go into the thing. He takes off the mask. They go down to the floor where the data dungeon is, and they go to the computer.
How are we still talking about the opening setup 43 minutes into this
podcast? I'm trying to get through it, Dan. They go to the computer. They set up the glasses so that the glasses can see the computer and the computer screen. They tilt the screen, which I thought was just an extra added bit of comedy.
They put the glasses behind him or like anywhere closer to actually see what was going on, because those things had like VHS resolution. There was no way they were catching anything over there.
No, well, but they were all shot with 35mm film cameras. They weren't actually using VHS resolution or anything. But the important
bad on the screen of that PowerBook.
Well, that's the screen, Dan. that's not what they were obviously shooting with film cameras. The reason why they do that is because it's like a red light camera. You got to catch the person with their face, and you got to catch the license plate, the computer, at the same time.
Yeah, exactly.
In the intersection, coming and going. And so that's why they had to set it up so that they could see the face and the computer screen. So make sure he was caught in the act. You wouldn't want to set it up from behind, because then you would just have the back of his head in the computer screen. And you want to set it up from in front, because then you just have his face and you wouldn't know that he was doing something illegal on the computer.
Those red light cameras are illegal here. They got rid of them all.
Okay. It's illegal in some places. Beverly Hills still has them.
We had them for a long time. They got rid of them.
Okay, so they have a bit of tension because the guy who's going to come get the thing is going to the elevator, and they can't get back up in the elevator because the elevator moved, and they can't get the thing hacked to do the thing. So then they finally hack the doors so that way they can hide under the elevator when the elevator goes down, and the guy goes in and he does the computer stuff, and they sneak out through a maintenance door that's at the bottom that leads to an unmonitored
directly outside.
Yeah, and it just led me to this question of, if that little door was there this whole entire time, why did they just go to this little door?
It only opens from the inside.
That doesn't make any sense. If it only opened from the inside, you could get in the elevator shaft from the top, like Emilio Estevez's character did.
Sure.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a little poorly thought out. If you're like really apply some logic to that, but that's not important because they have bigger fish to fry because they're there by the river and they're trying to do the standard kiss to pretend that we're not, you know, two spies standing around watching people.
Jack dies. It's bad. Mm-hmm. They're out there. They see the fella escape. He's got the disc, and they're like, "Uh oh, our plan's starting to go a little awry." John Voight's like, "You know what? Fine. You guys are screwing it up. I'm coming into the field. I'm going to do it myself. I'm old John Voight, but I'm better than all you guys apparently because I get to stay at the Drake Hotel."
He knocks over his chair.
He knocks over his chair. Yes,
I'm not sure
dramatic.
Why that was a shot in the movie.
Yeah, and then on his way, he's like looking behind him, and we don't see what's going on because it's very misty and it's very suspenseful. And he's like, "You know what? Abort everyone. We're being followed. We're being set up. This is bad." And you kind of believe him, although John Voight is not terribly believable when he says things because he's just the way he says things. But he's John Voight. Yeah, Tom Cruise is like, did you forget the part where the knock list is the guy's like standing right over there with this very important thing that we can't have out in the world? And John Voight's like, emergency, emergency, they're following me. I was trying to help, but apparently I made it even worse, so everybody run away. And Tom Cruise is like, no, we're doing it. And then they start dispersing and following him from all different angles. And Sarah follows behind him, and he's going to go around the block and head him off at the pass or whatever.
No, he's going to the bridge to protect Jim, who's being followed.
Yes.
Sarah is going to keep tabs on this guy, and Hannah is going back to the car to.
He's so passionate about like protecting the knock list that he's like, "You do that. I'm going to go help Jim." Which I guess you know the point of it is that like Jim's kind of his mentor or whatever. Like he doesn't want anything bad to happen to him. The reason he's willing to not obey the abort is because this is a very important mission, but he's like, "Yeah, you can handle this on your own. You're good. Don't worry about it."
Yeah. And on his way to the bridge, he passes Claire in the car, makes eye contact with Claire. And then we see Hannah get into the car on the passenger side, but we don't see Claire in the car, and the car explodes. Ethan runs over to the bridge. There's nothing doing there. There's no body because he fell over the side. And there's nobody around. So he heads back to try and save Sarah because now he's realized that Sarah's the only person left alive. And he tasks her with the most dangerous thing to do. And he's not able to get back in time because Sarah sees the guy over by a grate being stabbed and goes over, and she's just like, "Oh no." And then somehow gets closer enough to the grate to also be stabbed. And then Ethan Hunt finds them like that. And there is a drunk couple who was laughing and giggling the whole entire time, but who were obviously also spies who are watching this whole thing go down and doing zero things about this.
They're just there to observe.
Yeah, and so then Ethan Hunt is all like, "Oh no," and he panics and gets out of there because the Czech police show up on a speedboat, or a boat that has a motor. I don't know how fast that thing goes. And he gets to a payphone where he screws in a thing, which is some sort of filtering device, and makes a call to get a secure line.
I think
it's
one of those things where you were able to short across the wires and it would automatically let you dial something.
Mm.
Did you ever read 2600 Magazine? I'm pretty sure it was in there.
Can't say I did.
You get like a little pop tab and you stick it in there and it like shorts the wires and then it dials.
Hmm. Interesting. Yeah. But he places his call to the heads, the higher ups, and says everything's gone pear-shaped.
Central command, go secure, mm-hmm. Bleep bloop, everyone's dead.
Yeah, and Kittredge is like, "Well, I'm here in Prague, come meet me." And Ethan Hunt's like, "You're here in Prague? That's weird." And so he goes and he meets him at the aquarium restaurant, which is a neat set piece. I don't know. I'm going to assume that they built that whole little tiny thing because it's kind of a weird, weird thing to have otherwise, because it's basically just an enormous fish tank with almost no usable interior space. But he goes over there, enters the restaurant, and there are a couple patrons that are there. He sits down and he talks to Kittredge, and Kittredge is like, well, let's get you out of here. Here's the passport and papers. We get you back to Langley and we do a debrief on this whole thing, you know, how this all went. And then it starts to dawn on Hunt that something's gone awry, that things are not going to be better for him if he goes back, because it seems like he's being framed. And there's also the suspicious number of people that he recognizes, the faces that he sees in there. And so he's like, so all of these other people are IMF agents who are inside this restaurant because I recognize them from the party. And so you were also there at the party monitoring us. And he's like, well, that's because there was a mole and we had to make sure that the mole was found, etc.
He's such a good spy. He doesn't even know he's a good spy until he realizes he needs to access his super subconscious eidetic memory to remember who was there. And he's like, wait a minute, this is fishy, and not just because we're in an aquarium.
Oh, that was good. Kittredge is all like, yeah, so since you've figured out that I'm here on you figured out all these people are here, let me reveal the whole mole hunt plan to you, where that was actually a phony disc, we wanted to find who the mole was, who was leaking all this stuff. And now you're the only person who's left alive, so the mole has to be you, basically. And that he's going to take him in, and it doesn't look great for him. And he also reveals the whole thing about the 314 job. That comes into play later.
Fair point. Everyone's dead except him, so, like, suspicious.
Yeah, except Kittredge is, I think, a little overzealous in his maneuvering to abduct the person that he thinks is the mole, except if he, you know, it's one
well,
thing
says,
it's like,
why don't we exit here quietly and then we'll go back to our secret base and talk about it.
Yeah, and then Tom Cruise is like, no thank you, and then he puts the chewing gum on the glass of the aquarium, and then the one guy gets pulled out of the restaurant on a wire, I guess.
pretty hilarious. But you know this is the pivot where he's pissed because, like, he knows he's not guilty, and in his mind, Kittredge set up this whole elaborate thing to try and find a mole, and Kittredge's plan clearly didn't work very well because everyone died, and he didn't find the mole because he knows he's not the mole, so he's real mad at Kittredge, and he's just going to blow everybody up.
Yeah, and he gets out of the restaurant, and he does a weird run in the water. If you watch it, it's very kind of funny. But then he...
I like the way he does the jump, where he's got the arms up kind of like an orangutan.
Yeah, and then the one foot in front of the other in a weird wobbly way. Anyway, it's before you could look cool running from an aquarium, I suppose.
Nowadays, we have the technology to make people look cool while they're running from an aquarium.
Well, nowadays, they would have filmed him running like normal and then added digital water all around him.
Like a digital Kremlin or something, maybe.
Yeah, or just painted it so that he had a different performance or something. But they...
Just blind warp him.
Yeah, they have Tom Cruise go back to the crow's nest, bird's nest, empty nest, and he breaks some light bulbs that are in the hallway and scatters them on the ground. So that way, if anybody's coming, he can hear them break the glass.
Classic spy move. Very clever.
It's very clever. Except he spends an awful lot of time in the only place where he knows that they know that he would be, and they don't seem to care, which is strange. Nobody comes to collect this equipment or do anything about this facility at all, which is bizarre considering how motivated they were to find this mole and how much they knew about the mission that they were all on. So I don't know. I don't know what that's about. And anyway, he realizes that...
he probably just had the no housekeeping tonight sign on the door.
He realizes that... he gets passports and finds, like, guns and things, and starts putting together some stuff, and then he realizes that he needs to get in contact with Max, and that his only lead is this job 314, and then he realizes that it has to be biblical for some reason, and then it's going to be Job 314.
It happens to be a Bible directly in his eyeline when he's sitting at the power book. He's like, it couldn't possibly be this incredibly obvious, dumb code, because that would be too easy. But of course it is, and that is ultimately the undoing of the plan.
Yeah, and so he types in internet access, and then he goes on a website, and then he sends an email.
He's got a little pop-up box that says, like, Usenet groups, and he's scrolling through searches of news groups that are all in, like, size 60 Times New Roman font. It's very bad.
It's incredibly strange. And
hilarious to watch now.
Oh, so funny. He composes an email to Max at job:3:14, which is an interesting way to deal with email.
It's basically a Mastodon account these days.
He types out some stuff about how he wants to meet, and then a biblical passage to confirm that he has figured out the code. This is Job 3:14. And he sends that and then starts falling asleep at the computer, as everyone does. And he hears glass breaking in the hallway, and he looks up to see John Voight, his hands red. Why'd you leave me, Ethan? You failed me, blah, 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 blah. And then he realizes that he's having a dream or hallucinating, and it's actually Claire, who's there, Jim's wife, and she says that she got out of it and that she left the car to go on the bridge, and he's like, I was on the bridge. There's nobody on the bridge. And then she's like, yeah, I was there. Must have just missed you. And
I love the pose that he does, too, when he hops up and he cocks the gun, and he's got this, like, really, like, wide leg spread kind of, like, hard rock guitar player pose that he's got going on.
He definitely struck a pose. Then he, you know, realizes that he's going to work with Claire, and he's like, you don't want to be part of this. Like, you go to Kittredge, she's going to think you did it. You're either dead or you're with me. And then she's like, well, I'm going to go with you on this. And he's like, no, you can't do that. And then she's like, well, you said it yourself. I'm either dead or I'm with you. And then, so they're going to put together a team of people to break into Langley and do this thing. But first he's going to go to meet Max, because she replied to the email. Although we don't know it's a she at the time, and with the instructions about to go to this bus stop and buy a pack and then ask for a light. And so he does, and he walks up to the bus stop and he asks for the light, and then we get the close-up on the cigarette and the match, and then it goes out, and then the guy moves out of the way, and we see the car pull up.
Don't forget the blonde guy with the long hair who lights the match. He'll be back.
Yes. I will pay very close attention. But the car pulls up. And they go inside. And I should say the camera doesn't break this whole entire time. This is a oner. Into the car, where obviously...
Oh, this is the other POV scene that I was thinking was very interesting, because they pull the mask over top of the lens.
Yeah, and obviously you hear the car door close, but it's a full camera, full film camera, so they didn't. And then they say that he's got to put on this mask because nobody sees, you know, Max. He's going to talk to Max, and so blah, 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 blah. He does that, and then he's sitting there and says, like, oh, well, I'm not afraid to see her and die, see Max and die. And of course, this assumption is still a man. And the mask comes off.
I love the mask, by the way. It's so, like, homemade and terrible looking, but it makes me laugh. Especially the way he's, like, overacting and, like, moving his head around and looking around the room with this stupid thing on his face.
What's so strange, too, because they, like, did such a poor job stitching it all up together, and it's like, are you a Batman villain? What's happening? But
yeah, he's the Scarecrow, basically.
Yeah, but they take it off, and at his insistence that this was necessary for some reason, even though the Max is never seen by anyone. It doesn't really take a lot to wear them down on this policy. But Max is there, and it's Vanessa Redgrave, in her Vanessa Redgraviest. And she's the arms dealer, and she reveals that she, you know, had the mole and just working with this person that claimed that they could get the list, and why should she believe this guy who wants this money from her? Because Tom Cruise says he wants $150,000, and he's like, "Well, you gave Job $125,000, which is something Kittredge told him," and she says, "Oh, well, why would I do that? I got the list now." And he's like, "Oh, it's booby trapped. You put that in, it's going to start a tracker, and you know, like 30 seconds, 10 minutes, this place will be swarmed with IMF agents." And she's like, "I don't believe you." And
they
so
they represent this with the most amazing visual device too, with some sort of like RF tracking thingamabob, which is, I believe, we're intended to believe that it's tracking the radio frequency that comes out of the disc, which is calling for help to the CIA people, which is not at all how discs work or tracking would work, but it's kind of, I mean, it's very efficient and it works. It's just kind of funny.
Yeah. It's like there's some device inside of the disc that's powered by the spinning magnet disc part or something. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just sending out an SOS signal everywhere.
It's sending out an SOS to the world. But the, mm-hmm. yeah, they do a little clever cutting here back and forth where they try to build some tension of this, team coming to the building in white coats, and then they come inside and they draw guns on people and they're coming up through the floors, and, they're cutting back and forth with Max and Tom Cruise in the room. And then they finally, have the agents go into the room and they're already gone. They're long gone with all the stuff. And they're in a car, and she says that, you know, she thanks him and says, like, what do you want? And she's like, oh, well, I want the full list this time. No half lists, no part lists, not just Europe, just the whole kit and caboodle. And he says, well, I'll give you that for $10 million, because apparently $6 million was going to be the Europe list. And she's like, okay, I would gladly pay that. And you can have the $150,000 that you need for your resources, et cetera. And so he goes about setting up his team with Claire, using the disavowed list.
Yeah, still, they forgot to shut off his login to Langley, apparently, on Jim's laptop.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much of this where it's just like, if the government actually used computers in this fashion, wow, you'd be screwed. But they have Ving Rhames, who they're going to bring in because he's a computer expert on the disavowed list, and mm-hmm. then there's Claire wants Jean Renault, who is Krieger, and he's the expert that she recommends. And so they build this little team to go to Langley and break into the facility. And they do a clever thing that is repeated a lot of other times in many other things, where they do the heist movie thing of explaining the break-in process and the parts of the, you know, vault whatever thing that you have to deal with. And showing
it's very dramatic. It's yeah, good.
You cut to those things as you're having the characters talk about it. And so they do a situation where they talk about the alarm in terms of the floor sensor, and they talk about the alarm in terms of the temperature sensor, and they have a thing of him leaving his, what was it, coffee cup in the room or something, and the drop hits the floor and sets off the alarm in the little like interstitial thing where he's explaining the mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
And so they all go to Langley, and they impersonate, firefighters to get into the building. One of the firefighters hangs back and goes into another room and then changes clothes, and it's Claire. And, she follows the analyst agent guy, who is the one who has access to the stuff, as he goes to the break room.
Yeah.
And
the spoiler of it is kind of that, like, he laid out this impossible plan about how the security works, and they couldn't possibly defeat it by going directly at it, so they're going to have to go around it in some clever way. First way that they need to do that is to get the guy out of the room by poisoning him with a little pen that squirts goop into his coffee while he's taking a break. And he doesn't notice because, you know, Claire's a girl sitting next to him, and he just smiles and goes back to reading his newspaper. And then he gets deathly ill and continues to vomit for the next, like, 15 minutes while the firefighter boys prepare to sneak up through the air vent, which, you know, air vent. Like, how cliche could it possibly be, a spy movie, they're crawling through air vents? But they make it work.
Yeah. I mean, all air vents are man-sized. But it's... I think the really funny thing is probably the vomiting. But the they build this tension. They build this tension because there's the sound meter, the pressure sensor on the floor, and the temperature gauge. And so they know they need to control for all these factors. And Ving Rhames is doing the computer part and monitoring the situation. And Jean Reno and Tom Cruise are doing the actual, like, footwork, so to speak, of going through the ducts. And Jean Reno is lowering Tom Cruise into the black vault, which is white. Isn't that ironic? But
except the floor is black when it's unlocked, when you're mm-hmm. looking down, but when you're at eye level, it kind of reflects all the white. By the way, I love the design at the vault. It's so cool. It's got the giant sign by the door that says, like, countermeasures active on or off. It's like, it's so, like, 70s analog, like, Andromeda Strain art design that's just like, oh, yeah. I love it so much.
Oh, yeah. You get that Andromeda Strain 2001 Space Odyssey thing going on here. And you get all these really clever shots. The camera work here is very interesting. Just watch and rewatch the scene over and over again for the camera work, because they do all kinds of fascinating things. Like, they're following Tom Cruise down through this space. The camera's tracking with him. The camera's moving around as he's rotating, and he's, orientating himself to, access the computer, and they're doing whatever it was that gave them the password. And they've got the tension of Jean Reno holding Tom Cruise by this rope.
Which is an insane plan, but it adds so much additional tension to it. Like, he's doing these aerobatic things, dangling from the roof silently with his little tap shoes or whatever. But then they come back up to the vent. You've got Jean Reno up there just, like, struggling and sweating and just holding this rope. And it's like, oh, this is a bad plan. But it really does make you feel like, yeah, these are just four crazy people who just happen to be really good at their jobs, and they're just making it happen. They're just, like, not gonna screw up because they're that good.
Yeah. And you get the tension of the guys coming back, and so they need to pull him back up. So they hoist Tom Cruise back up, but they can't get him all the way up to the air vent, so he's just hanging there in the ceiling. And the analyst comes in, and you get that one really interesting Dutch angle split diopter where he's in the analyst's face is in the lower right corner and Tom Cruise dangling from the ceiling is in the upper left corner. And the whole thing's off kilter. So it just looks so strange, and it just adds to that tension. And because both are in focus, and they should not be, that you get that, that weird, sense of the audience knowing something that a character doesn't know, which they do a couple of times, especially in the sequence, because it happens to Jean Reno's character when the rat comes behind him. Jean Reno is in focus and the rat is in focus because it's something the audience is supposed to know and the character is not. So it very clearly communicates the character's not looking at the thing that we're looking at, and we can see the character's reaction. Whereas if you had the focus on the rat and not on the character, that you wouldn't have that same tension. And this is not an impassioned defense of split diopters being used in cinema. This is just, this was neat. So, you know, please use sparingly, everyone who's not Brian De Palma or Todd Vaziri. But I thought it was just a really interesting way to do it, because you don't have a rack focus. You're not going from the rat to Jean Reno. You're not going from Tom Cruise to the analyst and back and forth, which I feel like is a crutch that a lot of directors would rely on. It's like, oh, look at us going back and forth with the focus, and we're controlling where the audience is looking. Rather than do that, they're like, here are these two things. Isn't this crazy? And I feel like that works really well.
I agree. I mean, it's yeah. the Dutch split low angle diopter things. They're all fairly insane techniques.
Yeah, but it works in the context of this. Because they're not doing, like, a bunch of, like, quick cuts, and, like, the camera's not swinging around or anything. Like, everything's pretty tied down for the most part. Mm-hmm. And which you would have to do with the split diopter, but everything's
it's incredibly
pretty
tense scene too. Like, so the sitting still works well. It's incredibly quiet too, because, you know, again, sound is part of the thing. But, like, there's no score in this part of the movie. There's barely any sound design because they're supposed to be silent. But it's all so good.
It's very, very good at building the tension. And so the analyst vomits into a trash can, takes the trash can with him to go to the bathroom.
He vomits in a sink. He vomits in a toilet. He vomits in a trash can again. He goes back into the toilet. Lots of vomiting.
Yeah, so much vomiting. It's actually hilarious. But the
I gotta tell you though, somebody who's vomited a lot, I feel bad for that guy.
I mean,
there should have been a scene at the end where they're like, "Yeah, you know what? We'll send him a few bucks for his trouble." I feel bad.
Well, what I feel real bad about is they don't like get him back from Antarctica or wherever it was.
Right?
That they
sent he gets sent to a radio station in Alaska or whatever. Maybe yeah. Kittredge, like after they revealed that like we stole this stuff from you guys, but we had to clear our names. Maybe Kittredge was like, "All right, get that guy back." Like, there's nothing he could have done to combat the impossible mission force because it was literally an impossible mission, and they achieved the impossibleness of the mission. So it's not his fault that, you know, the mission was rendered possible by the impossible mission force.
Okay. Probably not. I think Kittredge is probably like, that guy screwed up that one time, and so he'll screw up again.
Plus, he would never want to be able to, like, he couldn't walk past that guy in the hallway at Langley and be like, "Hey, remember that time? Sorry about that. We're good now, though, right?" And he's like, no. This guy's either going to get sent to Alaska. Maybe a radio tower in Alaska is code name for, you know, like the farm upstate kind of thing. Like, they're just going to take him out back and shoot him.
God, that'd be terrible. But they're going to mail him his clothes. What do you think mail him his clothes means? Is that the shoot?
Mail him his clothes means burn his clothes. Like, send them somewhere where they can't be found.
Oh, yeah. That's another split diopter, by the way. But anywho.
It's a really weird one, too, because the split is only in, like, the left sixth of the screen. It's even at a bit of an angle too, so it's only like the upper left corner of the screen, kind of.
It is such a weird little sliver of the left side of the screen.
Plus, and like that scene and the scene where they invade Max's first place, where Tom Cruise has the mask on, are the two instances where Kittredge he legitimately stands 3 inches away from the face of the person he's talking to. It is incredibly uncomfortable. Like, it looks right on screen because you need the people in the frame, but he is so close to this other person's face.
Yeah, we saw some whispering banish this man, but,
yeah, but like, you don't need to be that close to whisper to somebody.
No, it's just fancy footwork here for this movie. So when the guy leaves to vomit, Tom Cruise goes back down and he gets the thing to do the thing, but John Renault gets the rat who sneaks up behind him, and then we cut back to Tom Cruise as he's being descended towards the floor before John Renault catches Tom Cruise and starts to try to like pull him back up, and they do the thing with the sweat of the droplet of sweat, which is obviously an eyedropper that deposited an enormous drop of water on the exterior of the lens.
I would like to state for the record that if I were wearing those glasses and I were as sweaty as he was or I have been, I could do that. I could do that to some glasses.
Well,
I have done that to the inside of my glasses because my glasses sit a little further away from my face, but I've had large drips of sweat go down the inside of my glasses.
It would be on the inside of your glasses. It wouldn't be on the outside of your glasses.
Well, he was wearing those horrible 90s glasses that are like very tight to the eye socket.
Well, they'd also probably slide off his face at this point.
Well, they gotta have good hooks around the ears. That's why he wore very specifically designed glasses with the camera in there.
Fancy glasses. But they get that under control. John Renault hauls him back up, and the whole entire time you cut back to John Renault, you see a dead rat in the corner of the screen. You're just like, how'd that happen? And I believe it was something that I first noticed was pointed out by Todd Vaziri. I didn't notice it in 1996, that's for sure. And I haven't seen the movie really since then, so I can't claim to have noticed it. But you definitely do see that there is a death rat in the corner of the screen that was previously alive. How did it die? Supposedly, Jean Renault like bit the rat and killed it. But they just do that off screen.
Is that what we're meant to believe?
I believe that is what we were meant to believe. But
I feel like he just threw like a hammer fist down on it with a whole lot of force, and that was all it took.
Maybe. Anyway, rat's dead. But it's there crumpled up in the corner. And they haul Tom Cruise back up. Jean Renault hauls Tom Cruise back up enough to do the rest of the computer stuff. He downs a thing, gets the thing. Then they get out of there. Right as Tom Cruise is going to get out, Jean Renault drops his knife, and you get a CG knife.
Specific, gigantic switchblade knife type thing.
I mean, is it really even a switchblade?
It's probably an automatic knife, but not an actual switchblade.
It had all those little notchy things on the side. That's just, it's a pretty gruesome knife.
It was a bad guy knife.
It's a bad guy knife. But the knife spins through the air in CG and then lands perfectly on the table, the desk. And they make their escape. They close it back up. The analyst guy comes back in after vomiting his guts out. And he sees the knife and he's like, that's weird. And he looks up and he sees the closed up air vent, and he reports this whole thing and he gets banished. And they escape by throwing a smoke grenade thing into the air vents, and that causes the building to be evacuated. And so they put on their fireman attire and
they usher
exit
Claire out and like nobody else.
Yeah. And they get to the fire truck. And at some point during that ushering process, Claire was put back into her fireman outfit. I don't know how they did that one serendipitously, but they did, and they left the scene, I guess, during the evacuation, which also seems weird because you'd be like, hey guys, we evacuated the building, why are you leaving? But the fireman truck leaves, and then they get back, they go to London somehow super easy, which is,
yeah, they
kind of
gloss over the fact that they fly all the way back to London, but like that's where Max is, so we figure out that they have to go there. But they go from like driving away from Langley, and all of a sudden they're in London. You're like, hey, wait a second,
just seems like there would be some difficulty or tension involved in the traveling process, but
you know, how many times did they slip through customs? The man's a ghost. Taught him how to do it, for God's sake.
Yeah. And so they get to London and they get a flat to let, and they let it, and they set up their little new crow's nest thing, where they're going to have their base of operations be there. And there's an argument that happens between Jean Reno and Tom Cruise's character, and they're, Jean Reno wants the disc, and he wants to be there with Max, and, you know, he doesn't trust Ethan Hunt to do this, blah, 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 blah. And Ethan's like, well, you don't have the disc. I have the disc. Here's my magic show. And
he does a Max Temkin where he spins around and he flips a disc and he does a thing and he does a show. And
Was this your card? But
Two of Hearts or whatever it was? Is that what it was?
Yeah. Oh, man. Two of Hearts. No, but he does the floppy disc magic show. And, well, not even floppy disc. I think it was one of those, like, optical.
It was a 230 megabyte disc. I don't remember what that is. It looks like a floppy disc, but it's hard, like, like a zip disc.
I think it's magneto optical. There was something that started with an S or something during the era.
But I don't care. I'm too busy Googling knives, and it's totally a switchblade.
Stop doing that. Somebody's gonna put you on a list.
It's a cool looking knife though. It's a $650 knife.
Okay.
Very expensive knife.
Why does anyone need that?
You know, cutting rope.
Cutting rope.
It's useful to have, you know, a knife for, you know, utility things sometimes.
Sometimes you're just walking through a park and then some old lady's like, help, there's a rope.
How many situations could benefit from having a pocket knife until you actually have a pocket knife. And you're like, you know what? I think I can handle this.
Not a pocket knife. There are no circumstances under which I would consider it to be a pocket knife.
I mean, it fits in a pocket.
This is a David. This is a, you know, like that's not a knife, Crocodile Dundee. This is a knife.
It's not that big.
It's pretty big. It's not as big as like a Bowie knife, but it's like a third the size. So it's large enough.
It's larger than most of the pocket knives I ever carried, but it's still a reasonable size. Oh wow, yeah. That's an even bigger version of the same thing.
Nobody needs this stuff.
Apparently they have holsters for these that you can put on your belt.
Well, it sounds like a sensible thing to do, because I wouldn't want that thing just jostling around in my pocket.
You don't want it in your pocket? You want it in like a Kevlar holster on your belt?
I mean, that would be sensible if I were someone who were to be carrying something like that around, but it just seems like a horrible idea. But
It's a pretty serious knife here.
It's very serious. But for some reason, Jean Reno is like, oh no, magic has confused me. I'm going to leave. And he throws his disc down ground.
Don't try any tricks with my money, or I'll stab you in the face or something. He says something pretty horrible like that.
Yeah, he's like,
I'll cut your throat or something. He's like, wow, take it easy there, man. Like,
yeah, he's just like, magic.
You started it, bro. You were the one who was being a jerk about it.
He just really believes in science, I guess. After Tom Cruise's magic scenario, he fishes the disc out of the trash and confirms that it was the real disc and that there were two discs, and that he wants Ving Rhames' character to hold onto the disc. And Ving Rhames is like, I don't want it. it seems like a terrible idea for me to hold that.
That's exactly why you need to have it, because you know that it's a very bad idea that we stole this, and you will protect it. And then Ving Rhames tries to figure out how to do a magic trick with it, which is kind of silly.
This is pretty silly. Because he's not even really trying very hard. But Claire and Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise goes into the room with Claire, and Claire is like in a sleeping bag, and then which seems like a terrible apartment that they rented. But it's all like, oh yeah, I'll be with you or whatever. Oh wait, no, I skipped over the part where he goes in. She shows him the TV thing of his parents and his mother and his uncle.
Something like that.
Yeah, his mother and his uncle being arrested as drug lords for some fake drug. And so they're like, uh-oh. So Tom Cruise runs over to the train station to place a call on a payphone to Kittredge and say that, that was a nice move, Kittredge, but I'm such a horrible mole, so why would it bother me? And it's like, well, you called me.
He's like, how did you get this number? What is the matter with you?
Yeah, and so they track, and then it's just like, almost got him. He's in England. He's in London. We need to nail him. Yeah.
Let's go there, and then, later, when Kittredge gets off of his helicopter, they immediately hand him a package with some tickets to the train. So he's like, this is suspicious. He's helping us a lot. I'm not quite sure what's going on here.
Yeah. Although he doesn't vocalize that concern. But after this phone call, Tom Cruise turns around and who's there but Jim Phelps, back from the dead. And Jim Phelps is all like, oh no, I'm so wounded. And
I'm coughing from being shot in the abdomen.
Yeah, and I no way I could be faking this. But he's just like, let's go sit down and talk. And he's like, he's like, we gotta get you to the doctor. And he's like, no, I can sit up straight, it just hurts. And then they chit chat about like what had happened, and he's like, oh, I fell in the river, and then I got out, but then wandered around for days. But I must have just missed you.
I saw my wife, and I didn't say anything because she looked so sad. It's like, what?
Yeah, his story is very bad. But the important part of the scene is that Tom Cruise realizes that his story is very bad, and he starts to piece together
the events that were happening. The whole thing here, because we do some more montaging, like we did earlier in the movie at the Langley scene, where he's telling a story, and then we're seeing the visuals along with it. But it's Tom Cruise putting together the whole scenario, and while he's sort of explaining it and talking it through with Jim in a very much like, yeah, this was Kittredge's fault kind of way, he's in his mind, he's seeing it from the perspective of like, oh, I know Jim did this. He's full of crap. How did he actually do it? And how would he have done it? How would I have done it if I was him? And he even goes through a couple different scenarios because he's still not certain if Claire is in on it. So he says like, okay, maybe Claire blew up the car. Maybe she didn't, because he could also have crawled out of the lake and then done it himself, crawled out of the river and done it himself. So he gets all the way through, and he realizes that he's full of crap and he was the bad guy, but he doesn't quite know everything just yet, and he also doesn't let John Voight know that he knows he's full of crap. But it's pretty clear. It's especially cool if you've seen this more than once to sort of know how the end goes and know a lot of the little pieces and see him thinking through that stuff too, because I think that's an additional help when watching this scene.
Yeah, and one of the things I like about it is the juxtaposition of that voiceover with the actions that are occurring, where he's saying Kittredge over and over and over again, because that's the conversation. But we see Jim every single time, except for that one with Claire. And then he doubles back on that with another Jim one. And so he knows to keep him at arm's length, like you said. And the weird part, just in case you were thinking like maybe, Tom's overreacting. This is the part where Jim Phelps goes, and don't tell my wife I'm still alive. I don't want to upset her.
And this is one of those ones where it's like, I think they do a pretty good job through most of the movie of dancing the line between that doesn't make any sense to also like, all right, maybe that does kind of make a little bit of sense. Because what he's basically saying is, let's maintain the status quo. Let's not throw another variable into the situation until we know who's bad and who's good and what the hell is going on, because we don't want any more carnage because it went bad so fast and everybody died. Like, let's just keep me hidden. You're the only one who knows about me, and we can sort of play this game and sort it out on our own. But at the same time, you're like, you don't want your wife to know that you're not dead, because that would be kind of like top of my priority list, I would think.
Yeah. His reasons for not letting his wife know, like if he had said, we can't let my wife know because she might be jeopardized, by this. Like, at least one of us needs to be out here, you know, monitoring the situation.
Instead of the creepy route of saying, like, Lord knows what she's had to do to cope with me being dead to get through the job.
Yeah, oh man. When he says that, too, he's like, oh, since, you know, with all this time that's passed, it's like, how much time passed? Like, in terms of the movie, it doesn't feel like it's that much time because we cut from place to place, basically instantaneously. Like you said, there's no travel or difficulty traveling. So, like, unless they were held up in customs for, like, 2 months, it doesn't really make any sense that there was a prolonged period of time where he was gone.
No. What he's basically saying is when they premeditated the plan and Claire was involved, he said, if you got to sleep with Ethan Hunt, do it, because we need him on our side.
Yeah. Which is confirmed later. But they go through the thing where Ethan Hunt goes back, and then Claire's like, oh, I'm here in my sleeping bag. I'm feeling very vulnerable. Come sleep with me. And it's like, gross. And then he sleeps with her. It's just like, gross.
I don't think we have any evidence that he actually did that.
Sir, I think you'll find that Ethan Hunt entered a room where a woman was in a bed and she made eyes at him.
She was sitting in a corner and she, like, nuzzled his hand and kissed it for once. And his face is like, what in the hell? So I like to imagine he was like, ah, you're feeling very distressed, I see. Why don't you get some sleep? He's not James Bond. He's Ethan Hunt. He actually legitimately cares about clearing his name.
No, I mean, if it was actually that scenario, they would have said no, but they didn't say no.
Didn't say yes either.
Yeah, but the assumption is yes because they cut away from that. Anyway,
I don't know, man. Ty goes to the runner in baseball, so.
I don't know. I think from the later discussions and the fact that Jim shoots her, that he feels like maybe things happened.
I feel like Jim is just bad, so I don't think that says anything.
Yeah, Jim is just bad. But
I'm
going to
Google this. Mm-hmm. Mission Impossible. Did Claire sleep with Ethan? Mm. 27 things you didn't know.
Well, Dave, we don't have time for that.
About this movie. No, you can't have my location.
Dan, mm-hmm, back away. Mm-hmm. Back away from it. Hit backspace on your internet access.
Engaged in a steamy kiss. That scene does not exist in the final cut. Filmmakers decided to scrap the love triangle between the three characters and didn't jive tonally with the rest of the film.
I feel like it's still kind of there.
So I feel like if they would have kept that stuff in the beginning of the movie, they probably would have extended this scene a little bit more because they would have had like a little bit more of a pre-established thing going on.
Yeah. Anyway, it doesn't feel appropriate. I feel like they should have just had him like not have any sort of hint of love. But anywho, they're going to go do the delivery with Max. And we had saw when we saw Ving Rhames earlier, he was messing around with the cell phone thing. So that comes up in a moment. We cut to the TGV, the TGV, if you are in France, I guess. It has the coolest little, like, train noise when they're, like, boarding time. Anyway, so they're going to go through the tunnel, which was a hot new thing at the time, and they're going to take the high-speed train from London to Paris, and it's in this train that the transaction is going to occur. So Ethan Hunt finds Max and her co-conspirator, and we get this lovely shot of this fly-in from some train track with a CG train on it into mm-hmm. the side of the train, into the set that they had built for the train. Mm-hmm. And they have the exchange between Ethan Hunt and Max via a phone call, where it's hidden underneath the chair, and she's like, this isn't what we discussed. And so she picks up the disc and gives it to the guy, and they see that it's the full list and stuff. And so she's like, okay, well, the payment for you is in the baggage car in this silver briefcase in this specific spot. And so he is going to go back there and get that. We also see John Voight disassembling a boombox, which is
great.
It's not something that most kids would recognize these days, but he's disassembling a boombox and assembling a gun.
Was like a metal detector or something to get on the train.
Yeah, like there are no weapons allowed on the train, so he's building his weapon was hidden inside the boombox. by disassembling it into these parts. And so he puts it back together.
Inside the boombox?
It'd be weird if they had him break it and then also Sprock Zarathustra had played. But so anywho, he assembles his gun, although we don't see his face, so it could be Ethan, but we totally know it's Jim. And he's leaving that car, and there's another guy in the background who's John Knoll. But so anywho, he's gonna go hunting for wabbits.
Hunting for hunt?
Yeah. Hunting for Ethan. Good Ethan hunting.
Goodwill Ethan. These are all very bad.
Yeah, but Max is like, well, we got to upload this thing. And the guy's like, my modem's not working. And then we see Ving Rhames at the other seat. And he's like, my Nokia has a light on it.
He's got a thing up on his screen that has an outline of a phone. And it's he writes, send jamming signal on the keyboard. And it totally doesn't match the way he typed it. It comes out like really fast. No.
It's very funny.
But he's sending the jamming signal, which apparently means an orange blinking light on his Nokia.
Yeah. And so that's jamming the thing. And they're like, oh, we can't do it. We got to send this before we get to the channel because then we won't be able to transmit it. And I want to make sure we get this data, blah, 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 blah. There's a guy coming through the cart and it's Kittredge. And so Ving Rhames is worried that he'll be recognized. So he backs out of the cart by taking, his thing, and the guy hands him the phone, and then he's walking away and all everybody's phones are going off. And then Max realizes there's something fishy going on, but it starts transmitting again. So they just stay in their seats. And Ving Rhames is pursued by the stringy blonde haired guy. But then that guy turns around later and goes back.
Well, cause you know, Kittredge sees him like some large dude trying to like break in the bathroom door, and he's like, this might be a thing that concerns us, so let's go take a look.
Mm-hmm. And in the baggage car, we have Claire enter the baggage car, and she sees what is presumed to be Jim Phelps, John Voight, sitting in dramatic lighting on the other side of the baggage cart, and she says, I don't think we should kill Ethan Hunt and blah, 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 blah. And he's over there. But your plan worked perfectly. We'll just get out of here with the stuff. And then Ethan pulls off the mask in the dramatic lighting still. And we're doing a morph between the pull-off gag and the John Voight thing. And so it's like, oh, man, computers. And Claire's like, uh-oh. The guy who can impersonate anyone impersonated Jim. Didn't see that one coming. And he yells at Claire for a bit, and then Jim reveals that he was there the entire time watching himself. I don't know. It's weird. He steps out of the shadows, and he's in his tactical John Voight gear. And
his parachute outfit.
Yeah, he's got his little pistol, and he's going to shoot Ethan. They want the money, and Ethan's like, okay, here you go, and he hands them the Barabond coupon things, and Claire's got them, and then there's the whole, like, don't shoot, and blah, 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 you knew this, and stuff, and he's like, well, you're the only one who's seen me, and like, I'm not the only one, and then he does the magic trick of, here are the glasses.
It's pretty good, too. I like the dramatic reveal there with the music or whatever, and you're like, I know what he's doing, but, yeah. And then I very much enjoy, again, my boy Kittredge, where he says, morning, Mr. Phelps, looking into his little Apple Watch with a video screen on it.
Yeah, because one of the things that was in the package for him, aside from the train tickets, was one of these watches. Although we just saw the watch band, so we didn't really realize it was the specific watch that had the little video interface that they had used a couple times.
Yeah.
But
I don't know if he got a Fitbit or a Series 4 or a Series 5. It's hard to tell.
Very hard. But they have the... instead of shooting Ethan Hunt, Phelps hits Ethan and shoots Claire.
He shoots Claire first, and then Ethan like attacks him, and he's like, "You know what? Screw you!" And like kicks him in the stomach and smashes him against the thing, and then like runs out the roof. But like you could have shot him.
Why wouldn't you just shoot Ethan?
He was in a hurry to catch his
helicopter
before they hit the channel.
Yeah, because Jean Reno has been following them in a helicopter.
As you do.
You gotta have a backup plan, and the backup plan is a helicopter to chase your train. And so the helicopter gets lower and lower and lower, trying to get towards the train before the tunnel, but the tunnel it hits them first, so to speak, and the helicopter sneaks into the tunnel, flying very low, dangerously low, and you'd be like, oh wow, this must have been hard. And it's like, well, it's computers, and
it's computers.
very complicated blue screens and things, and they have a fight on the train with some air blowers that were like actually like forceful enough to move their mouths and lips around, which is astonishing really when you think about
it. Pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like most movies don't even bother, or especially most television shows.
No, they definitely don't bother.
No, there's just like, yeah, there's wind, and it's like, is that like one of those oscillating fans somewhere off in the distance that somebody like turned onto four, mm-hmm. and then just let it rip?
His shirt is legitimately flapping so hard it looks like it was going to burn his skin off.
Yeah, it looks like there's actual significant force occurring. And
hell, the wind looks like it's moving faster than the train does.
But they have their fight, and there's like the flippy and the shimmying and the stuff.
The flippy and the shimmy and the what have you here.
Yeah, sorry, I was channeling my my very great comedian with the glasses, Oikevold. But they get to the end of the thing where there's the other train engine guy who's at the back, and he's like, hey, there's a lot of weird stuff happening right now. And there's a lens flare of the helicopter that's anamorphic, even though this is spherical VistaVision. They do their stuff of the fight, and they trying to get on the helicopter, and the helicopter blades are getting lower, and John Voight gets onto the helicopter on one of the little leggy things, and the helicopter is trying to get Ethan, and he gets onto the other side of the helicopter, and then he gets the chewing gum out and sticks it onto the bottom of the helicopter, and there's a lot of banging around and hitting things, and helicopter tips and stuff, and there's explosions.
It was a very, very cool, gigantic bang, and it launches him back onto the train when the helicopter explodes. And it's very cheesy. It's very action movie, but I do love the way the helicopter continues to tumble, and it's got this like jagged helicopter blade that stops like an inch from his neck.
That's, I feel like that was gilding the lily a little bit.
No, it's perfect because it doesn't last too long. He's just like straining. He's straining, and he's like, "All right, it came to a freeze frame, basically, with this thing like pointing right at him." And then the guy with the funny face inside the train car stands up and is freaked out, and then he faints.
Fainting. Nah, didn't care for that. But so anyway, mission possibled, and they have solved the scenario, and everything is hunky-dory. We know that because Ethan Hunt, the events are mentioned on the screen. Oh, Max is apprehended by Kittredge, by the way. But they have a newscaster say that a helicopter descended into the tunnel and the pilot died. And isn't that weird? And then they pull back on that until they reveal Ethan Hunt walking out of the building, and he's got a leather jacket on.
Again, he's having a beer with Luther because, you know, mission achieved or whatever.
Yeah, and they sit down, and they have their little chit-chat, and Luther's Vingrames character is back in it. He's been recommissioned, he's been reavowed, and Ethan Hunt's like, nah, it's not for me, I'm going to retire, and it's like, ha, joke's on you. But
Cinema of the Caribbean.
Yeah, and so he's doing the same thing, same set, of being on a British Airways 747, and the flight attendant's coming around with the movies, and she offers him a movie, and he's like, I'm not interested. And she says, well, can I interest you in the Cinema of the Caribbean, perhaps Aruba? And then it's the same thing, and the sting, the little music thing goes up, and then we get the credits with the techno remix of the Mission Impossible theme.
Awesome techno remix.
Yeah.
Just makes you want to crack some glow sticks and go at it.
Was this Moby? Like, what was going on with this one?
No, I Shazammed it because I was actually curious, and I did not recognize the name. It was Adam Clayton and Larry Mullen? Does that mean anything?
Zero things to me.
Me too.
All right, well, that was good. It was a good show. They did the thing. they did the thing and the stuff, and they got off the airplane. They got off the airplane by going to the credits, and then there's no after credit scene or anything.
Got off the airplane by going to the credits. Yeah, it got.
Sorry, I was distracted. I'm receiving text messages from India right now.
Oh well.
Yeah.
Good morning.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good ending because he's like, every time I think I'm out, they pull me back in or whatever. But you can tell that like he got the job, he got the promotion, he did the goal, he impossibled the mission.
Yeah.
And it's going to lead us on a very long series of films that will get progressively more insane.
Yeah.
Actually, I think it ebbs and flows. I think two is a high point for absurdity. And then I feel like four is pretty crazy. Yeah. And then six gets pretty crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We'll see what happens in seven and eight.
So basically the even numbered ones are the worst ones?
No, I wouldn't say they're the worst ones. They're crazy.
Yeah. Well, it's sort of the inverse of Star Trek movies.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly
which
what
is interesting.
It is.
Did you know that Mission Impossible and Star Trek are siblings?
In what way?
They were greenlit at the same time by Lucy Arnaz. Lucille Ball.
Are you talking about the originals?
Arnaz. Yeah. Because she put the series out when she was trying to save the studio, and then blew a lot of money, and they had to sell the studio to Paramount. Then it was a Gulf and Western company for a while and some other things, and then CBS and not CBS, and then stuff.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
It's fascinating.
I feel like, though, it'd be weird if you had a reboot of Star Trek where the Enterprise crew all died except for Captain Kirk, and then he's got to avenge them. And then you turn that into a series of just Kirk going on and doing crazier things.
I mean, honestly, that would be a less ridiculous reboot than like, there's a black hole and it's a parallel universe.
Yeah,
a lot of your same characters, but it's different.
Yeah, but you want characters, though. Characters welcome.
Make some characters. Like, you know, make some new ones that we care about.
Well, I'll have to revisit as we're doing this. Obviously, revisit two and see if characters are welcome there.
Oh, in Mission Impossible 2? Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, because I don't feel like they were. And then...
Look, I'm not going to lie to you. Mission Impossible 2 is going to be tough to get over. Like, it's a speed bump in the road. But then once you do that, you're going to get to three, where it gets a little grittier and a little more real, and you're going to go like, oh, interesting. That was a different pivot. It looks like there's still some potential in this franchise. And then you get to four, and you're like, what is happening, Brad Bird?
Because it goes from David Cup and Brian De Palma to John Woo with Brandon Braga and Ronald D. Moore, which is another weird Star Trek connection. And then it goes to Brad Bird with somebody else doing the writing?
Number three is J.J. Abrams.
Oh, J.J. Abrams. Alex Does J.J. Abrams write three?
No, it was Alex Kurtzman and Roberto Orsi.
Ah, his buddies.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I guess Abrams has a writing credit on it, too. And then you go to Brad Bird. I forget who wrote that one. Mission Impossible 2011. Bruce Geller. No, that's the
guy who did the original series.
First credit here. Josh Applebaum and Andre Nimick.
Okay.
Yeah, whatever. And then you go into the Macquarie era, right? Mission Impossible. Rogue Nation, which is Macquarie, writer and director, and then samesies for Fallout.
Mm.
I believe. I'm not going to look at it because we'll get there.
Yeah.
But yeah, so you know.
Pain awaits us.
Number two is not going to be easy because there's really bad masks. There's that song. There's John Woo and his doves. And then
there's the motorcycle thing.
There's an absurd premise. There's some cool John Woo-ness. I'm not going to lie. There's some cool John Woo-ness. But on the whole, it's just a bad haircut and some weird slow-mo and some doves. Mm-hmm. But then you get to three, and then stuff starts to get real.
Okay. Does he throw Oakleys that explode?
In number two.
After climbing up to the top of a mountain?
Only in number two. I don't think Oakleys make a comeback after number two.
Okay. It seems very time period specific.
Wait, when did three come out? Is that officially out of... Yeah, that's no longer in the 90s, so there you go.
I feel like there was a very big lull between two and three, if memory serves.
2000 to 2006. So the first one was 96, yeah. Then 2000, then 2006, which is it's a fair gap. But then you go 2006 to 2011, so it's another big gap.
Yeah. The gap years.
And then 2015 and 2018. So they're ramping up in frequency.
Mm-hmm.
But still.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll get there when we get there.
Mission possible.
Mm-hmm.
So hot in here.
Yep.